We continue the shiur in Gemara. We're on Gemara Masechet Hadiyos, the last paragraph in that Gemara, which means that we are about to make a siyum on this Masechet. It is a Gemara that we've discussed, learned many times before. You've had this siyum before, so the topic should be very familiar. However, there is never a case of a Ein Beis Medrash B'lein Chiddush. So possibly, for those who are not extraordinary geniuses, possibly you may find something new. The Gemara says there is a machlekes, a debate in the Gemara between Tanoim as to which one of these two is greater. One type of person is called Sinai. Sinai refers to Mount Sinai. Mount Sinai refers to the receiving of the Torah. And as we know, we believe, as the Torah states, that on Har Sinai, the entire Torah was taught to Moshe Rabbeinu. Entire Torah means the Chumash, the Gemara, the commentaries, the different levels of Torah, the Kabbalah, so on. Everything, every facet of Torah was taught, was brought down on Har Sinai. So the word Sinai is the symbol for a vast amount, the compilation of the entire Torah. That is one. A person who is called Sinai means one who is filled with knowledge. He's a walking encyclopedia of Torah. That person, as compared to one who is called Eiker Horem. Eiker Horem means one who has such mental powers, such mental strength, that he can actually tear up a mountain by its roots. Which means that his mind is very sharp. He can delve very deeply into a topic and analyze it. Such an analytical mind, he can discover new depths in the topic of Torah that he studies. He is not that well informed. His knowledge is not that broad. But the amount that he knows, the limited amount that he knows so deeply and so sharply, he could arrive at a greater depth, at a deeper understanding, sharper than a person who is Sinai. So we have these two people. Which one would we prefer to have as our leader, as our guide? One who has the vast amount of all the different facets of Torah, but whose mind is not that sharp. Of course, a person still must be very sharp to learn that much Torah. He's not unusually sharp. Or one whose mind is so profound, so deep, that at least the topic he's on, he can delve much deeper than the person of Sinai. But you cannot get information from him on all topics. His knowledge is limited. So again, we have this question, vast knowledge or depth? Sharpness of mind. This is a machlekes, a debate. The Gemara says that in later generations, among the Menoyim, this debate came to the forefront where it had to be resolved because the question materialized. With two of the Menoyim who were about to being selected as candidates for chief rabbis, Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Yosef and Rabbah. Rav Yosef was known as Sinai. Yosef had this vast knowledge, clear knowledge of the entire Torah. And Rabbah was known as Eiker Horem. He didn't have the amount of knowledge of Yosef had, but he had a greater perception, greater depth. And the leaders of that city had to choose between these two. How do you select? So they sent a message to Eretz Yisrael, the leaders of Eretz Yisrael. They asked them, which one of these two should we pick? Which one is better? The reply came back from Eretz Yisrael, between these two, Sinai is definitely superior. Sinai is better, one who has a knowledge, because everyone without exception needs the master of the provisions. Provisions for everyone. The Sinai has Torah for everyone. The Eiker Horem has a limited supply. He can give his knowledge to those who are very sharp-minded. And if someone needs information on other topics, he's limited. So between these two, everyone needs the Sinai, and therefore you should select Rav Yosef. Now, Agav, how come that one person becomes Sinai, and the second person becomes Eked Hodom, Charef, sharp? Or brief, they call it a Buki and a Charef. Buki means a clear knowledge of all the parts of the Torah, and Charef means sharp mind. In this case, we have a definite, clear indication as to why Rav Yosef was Sinai. Because Rav Yosef was very famous. The Gemara says he was famed for one quality, special quality. The Gemara says that Rebbe Yehuda Nasi was known as the greatest onov possible, most humble leader. Rebbe was the Nasi, and yet he possessed a humility, a humbleness that was unparalleled. So when the Rebbe was nostalgic, the Mishnah says, the Tana of the Mishnah said, Rebbe was nostalgic, the quality of Anova disappeared from the world. There is no longer any Anova. There are people who are humble, but that's not real humbleness. The real humbleness, the real shiftless, the real Anivus, this Anova was contained in Rebbe, and now there exists no longer any more this quality. This is what the Tana said. Rav Yosef, at that time, he learned this Mishnah, spoke up and said, erase those words from the Mishnah. There's a mistake there. Because I am still here. I have the Madrega of Anova that's as great as Rebbe. Which dates back, of course, to Meshe Rabbeinu. Real Anova, Ish Meshe Onav Miyot. Tadis of Meshe was greater Onav than anybody on earth. And this Anivus, this to a degree that be possessed, Rav Yosef said, I have this too. Rabbeinu Zal explains that when Rav Yosef said, I am an onov, I am very modest, that doesn't mean he's boasting, chas v'shalom. So how can a person be modest if he says, I'm modest? Rabbeinu Zal says that the highest degree of modesty is when a person could very humbly say, I am the most modest person on earth, without feeling any degree of conceit. Moshe Rabbeinu had that quality. He was able to read and write the words of the Torah and write about himself that he was the most modest person on earth without feeling any degree of haughtiness. So this was the ability, the quality, the degree of the Anivos Av Rav Yosef, who said, erase those words because I am the true Onav. I possess Anova. Now, in order for a person to have a true zikoron, the Gemara says that a person, anybody, anyone, could develop a sharp mind. Take the dullest brain, a lot of dull brains around, they're not to be depressed. Dull but not depressed, because every person, no matter how dull his mind is, has the opportunity to sharpen his mind. Keep studying, keep plugging away. It's just like drops of water on a stone. Eventually they'll bore a hole through that stone. So if a person's mind is like a rock, you can't penetrate it, keep pouring the water of Torah on it. Constantly keep studying Torah. It will finally penetrate, go through, and it's like taking a dull piece of steel on a stone, rub it, scrape it, and hone it till it becomes as sharp as a razor. This is the nature of a person's brain. It may be born with a dull mind, but he can develop it to become the sharpest mind. This could be done. But a person cannot develop a memory. A lot of places advertise memory schools, memory training, and so forth. The owner says that's not true. Those are all good schools for the owners to make money with. But as far as developing a mind that will retain that which a person studied, you cannot do it through hard work, through study, review. People who could study, read a thing over 100 times, and the next day they've forgotten everything they read. Because they haven't got what? They haven't got the effort. The effort is there. They haven't got the blessing from heaven. It's a special siyata mishmaya. Help from heaven alone. How do you get that? You've got to get the assistance from heaven. You cannot do it yourself. Your efforts are in vain. Your efforts are good to sharpen your mind. But to develop the memory, you have to have the siyata, the assistance from heaven. How does a person get the assistance from heaven? A simple means, of course, is to daven for it. You pray and you hope that your tefillah is answered. But the true key to invoke, to arouse the will in heaven, to give you this brain, this retentive memory, is only through anova. A person who is very humble and very modest, that person in heaven is considered the true candidate to be gifted with this special type of memory. So the key to memory, which means vast knowledge, you learn a lot, but if you forget, you retain very little. To learn and to keep that knowledge, to accumulate, to amass a vast amount of knowledge, this is through anova, which Rav Yosef had. And that's why he's called Sinai, because anova is begimatria Sinai. A person has this anova, then he's called Sinai, which means covering the entire Torah. This is how Rav Yosef was Sinai, Rabbo was Charif, and they told the people, fine, now take Rav Yosef as your leader. And of course they offered Rav Yosef the position. Rav Yosef turned down this offer. Why would he turn it down? Gemara says because he had been informed by those who are able to see in the stars the future of a person. The stargazers knew. Those days they could tell. They could see a person's fate and future. Told Rav Yosef, you are going to rule. You'll be a king. Nasi, chief rabbi, is like a king, in fact, in a higher position. Told him, you're going to rule, you're going to reign for a period of 2 years. That's the length of your reigning period. So he knew he was insured that he'd have 2 years of being Nasi. After those 2 years, it meant most probably he would pass away. Because you do not depose, dethrone a Nasi, as the scandalous conditions they have in Eretz Yisrael today. They appoint the chief rabbi, they elect the chief rabbi, they vote for him. They don't consider a person through knowledge. There's no way of voting for a chief rabbi. Chief rabbi develops by himself. A goyin is not voted. You don't vote this person to go because he has so many votes. A goyin is one who develops and is recognized by the Taita world, the Gedolei Taita, as one who is superior in knowledge. He's a goyin. The greatest of all the goyinim is one who's accepted and recognized and known to be the chief rabbi, the Nasi. Not one who's elected, and then, after he's elected finally, they have new elections after 5 years, and this goyin is shamedly, disgracefully dethroned. It's like assassination of character. You're not fit to be a goyim because some yokels got together, politicians, and voted them out of office. You vote a rabbi out of office, you removed his smicha, you removed his knowledge, you're no longer a goyim. This is the impossible, the disgraceful, and the shameful that we have today. In those days, of course, Kovod HaTorah was properly respected, and so one who was selected for his greatness as a Nasi remained as such until his astalkus, till he passed away. So Rav Yosef knew he now had the key to life. If he would take on this position, he'd have to pass away in 2 years to fulfill that prediction, prophecy that was seen in the stars. If he could delay this now, he'd live that much longer. So he said he deferred this position in respect to Rabbo's superiority and knowledge. This was done with sincere humbleness. Rabbo, he said, is greater than I am, he's deeper than I am, and therefore let him take over. It is more fitting that you have Rabbo as the Nasi, as your leader.
I'll wait until a later date to take over. And so because of that humbleness, of course, Rabbah reigned for 22 years. Rav Yosef lived throughout that period of 22 years. He was very wary, very careful of not exerting any authority, because perhaps if he'd use any authority at all, he would order anybody to perform any kind of task, this might be construed as reigning. So the reign, the stargazer said, you'll reign for 2 years. If in those 2 years' time he'll order somebody, he'll have some servant or someone to assist him with anything, to obey his orders, that might constitute his reign, and he'd have to pass away then. So during this time, 22 years that Rabbah was Nasi, Rav Yosef never issued any order whatsoever. He never even called a doctor to his house. A doctor is usually, those days, there was a time when doctors were more sincere in their efforts to cure, to help, even though they don't know anything, but at least they tried. They would pay, they'd make house calls. Nowadays, the only visit by the doctor is in the mail, his bill. But you'll never find a doctor belittling himself to go visit an ordinary, mundane creature, a peasant, as doctors consider laymen. So, Rav Yosef, in those days when it was customary for doctors to visit the home, not really a doctor in a full sense, because surely he'd have no contact with such characters. He used to have these makis dam, ones who would let blood. When there was some kind of an illness or a disease, they would relieve themselves by leaving some blood out from the arm, by letting out a pint of blood, and the disease would come out with that blood. He would go to the doctor's, to the makis dam, his bloodletter's office, and there have it performed. Of course, this meant for himself and his family, which in essence means that because he was that humble, he was blessed that he never had to use a doctor at all. There was no illness in his house during that period of 22 years. This was his blessing. At the end of those 22 years, Rabbah was nostalgic, he passed away, and then Rav Yosef first took over. The Gemara says that Rav Yosef reigned for a period of 2.5 years. Strangely, this was against the prediction by the stargazers. They said 2 years, and of course they would be right. This is what the stars showed. But again, that fate itself was changed. Again, because of his humbleness, because of his anova, he gained the additional half year. He was granted a half year because up till a half year it still counts as part of, it's not 3 years. So he had the additional half year as a bonus given to him. For 2.5 years he acted as chief rabbi, as Nasi of that city after Rabbah's reign. Now again, we have this question of Sinai, Boki, and Charif. Sinai means one who learns a lot, and Charif, Ekehara, means one who learns deeply. This is very similar to the Gemara's advice. The Gemara says in Shabbos, Ligma Adalispa. Shabbos, the Brachas, the person's advice to a person who's learning Teda, learn a lot, very quickly, cover as much as you can. Abinadol says, drink in as much Teda as you can, very quickly, and then the second time around you can go very slowly and whisper to understand in depth. This is what the Bnei Yisrael did at Har Sinai too. When they were told, they were offered the Torah, the reply was Naaseh v'nishma. Exactly, Naaseh means we'll work diligently, we'll cover a lot of Torah. That's the key. Learn a lot, amass a great amount of knowledge. Nishma means to go into depth, deeper perception, and then the second time around we'll study much more deeply. This is the true combination. Of course, if a person can develop this, Rabbeinu Zal advises a person should try to be a combination of both Sinai v'Eiked Horem, and that can be done only by following this advice of Na'ase v'nishma, Ligma v'lispa, to start at first very quickly, go through as much Sforim as you can, and then a separate shiur, slow shiur in depth. The Gemara says further that the next generation came up, the same problem arose. Whom to elect, to select as the chief rabbi. There were four candidates this time, and the four were Abaye and Rava, Rabbi Zeda, and Abba Bar Masna. A leader had to be chosen, and they said, let's select the leader by seeing which one is the most superior present, sharpest one present. Let each one say something, make a statement. If the others could disprove a statement, he's out. If one of them can refute any attempt at disproving a statement, he remains as king. Everyone tried, and Abaye was the only one who remained. Abaye, of course, was chosen. Now, it's noteworthy, in this case, note that this was the next generation because Abaye was the official Talmud of Rabbo. Rava was the official Talmud of Rav Yosef, Talmud Muvhak. So that both inherited from their Rebbes the quality of their Rebbe. Rava was a Sinai, the same as Rav Yosef. That's why we find in the Gemara that the vast majority of debates between Abaye and Rava then remains like Rava, because we need wider knowledge to be able to resolve a din. In most cases, except for Yal Kegum, it remains like Rava. Abaye was a Talmud of Rabba. In fact, he was the adopted son of Rabba. Abaye's real name was Nachmeni. He was the nephew of Rabba, the son of Rabba's father's brother, or Rabba's brother's son. And his name was the same as Rabba's father, Rabba Bar Nachmeni. Now when he adopted Abaye, he could not call him by his name, because a person is not allowed to pronounce his father's name. So since Abaye's name was the same as Rabba's father, he called him instead Abaye, without the dot in the base, it's Avi. Our Bez Yud, Yud Avi, you are like my father. I cannot say what your name is, so Abaye Avi instead of Nachmeni. He was an adopted son, and his main disciple, official Talmud Muvhak, brought up by Rabba, and Rabba would put every bit of effort into strengthening, sharpening the mind of Abaye. That's why Abaye took over, developed the quality of Rabba in Harifus, the sharpness. Abaye, of course, also sharpness means din. Abaye was a Gilgul of Rav Yeva Sova, in turn a Gilgul of Rav Akiva, who was all din. So, in this case, we see that Abaye then took over, because they themselves decided the leader should be the one who had the sharpest mind, and this, of course, too, was a continuation of their own Rebbe's. They felt that their Rebbe's, too, between Rav Yosef and Rabba, though they should have chosen the Sinai, as the leader of Israel said, still between their Rebbe's, Rabba was selected. Rabba took over the leadership, therefore, Rabba gave leadership to Abaye, and after Abaye's Astalkus, Rabba took over Abaye's leadership. This is the end of Masechta Hadius. With this we make a siyum on not just Hadius, but actually on the entire Seder Nezikin, one of the six Sedarim of Shas. And of course the Gemara says a person who wants to gain sharpness, speaking about sharpness, a person wants to gain chachma, he should learn Seder Nezikin. This is something that sharpens the person's mind. Let's hope that we have gained a lot of chachma, a lot of wisdom, by learning this Seder, and that we're zecher to learn, continue to learn, and to gain both Bekiyas and Chalifos. Now there's another Masechta in Nezikin, which we do not learn now. That's Masechta Ovais, Pirkei Ovais, which is only Mishnayos, and that's learned especially during the season, the summer season. Many reasons for it. We study that on the Shabbosim, so we'll save that Masechta for the summer season. However, there is a Hakdama. Before we go on to the next Seder Kodshim, the Gemara Seder Kodshim, there is Masechta Ovais, the Hakdama to Masechta Ovais, the preface, and then there are a number of small Masechtas that do not count in Shas. They're known as Masechtas Kitanis. Well, they have different names for them. We'll try to cover those two. First, a very interesting Hakdama to Masechta Ovais, though we will skip Masechta Ovais, but the Hakdama will take up. This Hakdama is written by the Rambam Zal. It's called the Shmoina Prokim, the eight chapters of the Rambam Zal, in preface to Masechta Ovais. These eight chapters, we must state, we cannot skip this point, we must state that there is a risk, there is a danger. Rambam Zal was Kodesh V'Toher, one of the greatest tzaddikim that ever lived, one of the greatest Taita, recognized by the world as the fount of Taita. All yeshivas where they learn Taita deeply, Pilpul, the Pilpul revolves generally around the Rambam Zal. You'll practically never find a Pilpul profound discourse in Taita without the mention of the Rambam. That's sort of a key to it. A person who mentions the word Rambam is automatically on a higher level in learning. But that's in Gemara. There are different phases, different sforim that Rambam wrote, sforim that deal with philosophy, which are forbidden for us to delve into. Rabbein Ezel writes at length. We've had a number of shiurim on this topic. There'll be more to come about the iser of learning philosophy, no matter whose philosophy it is, no matter who the author is. We've gone through this topic before as to why the Rambam wrote this. Rambam himself could, but we cannot. It is forbidden for us to learn this topic because it is so damaging that no person can delve into it without coming out harmed, without destroying at least part of his emunah. A person should see to it to build a fence, a protective armor around his faith, and that armor can be punctured, can be penetrated, can be destroyed if he goes into the study of philosophy. Therefore, philosophy is so usur that it's called a one-way ticket to Gehenna, Rahman al-Islam. Well, in the Rambam, the Yad HaChazaka, the vast volumes of the Rambam on Gemara, Pilpul, that of course is one of the keys to Taita. Gemara. The other sections which deal with philosophy, as we said, are not to be studied. The Shmoina Prokim touches lightly on certain aspects of philosophy, and therefore this requires very careful selection. There's some very interesting information on the Shmoina Prokim. We've been very careful to pick. We're not going to take it in order straight because we've got to omit certain passages. But you can feel secure in the part that we will discuss where the philosophy part is eliminated. Again, it's a fascinating study, the preface to Pirkei Ovais. We'll try to cover as much as possible to understand as much because it's a very deep topic. Deep, but we'll bring it down to a level where everybody can understand it. At least to our own level, which is not that profound at all. Rambam begins by stating that the nefesh of a person, the nefesh is the spiritual portion. Every person who is alive is made up of physical, that's the body, the guf. The body itself has 248 organs, 365 tendons, a total of 613 components, which match parallel the 613 mitzvahs of the Torah. That's the physical part of the body. Every single part of this body must have in it a spiritual power to keep it alive. Otherwise, it's a dead item. When a person dies and the nefesh leaves, that body is like a stone. And as far as mobility, we discussed the fact that there remains always a slight portion of kista dechusa, a drop of life, even in a dead body too. But the not enough to give it mobility, to give it any action. So this nefesh penetrates into every part of the body, giving it life. Now, speaking about the nefesh of the person only, which means we have to deal with the spiritual part of the person, yet it is that spiritual part which gives power to the physical part to move. The nefesh of a person, of a living person, is only one. Each person has one single nefesh. There are some, mechakrim means those who delve into philosophy, other aspects, who mistakenly believe there is more than one nefesh in a person. Now, of course, this is, has no relation to what the Zohar Kodesh says about the nefesh, ruach, neshama, chaya, yechida, the five parts of the soul. Speaking now not about these five parts of the soul, but the soul as a unit, a spiritual unit. There are some who think there is more than one spiritual unit, and of course this is false. As for instance, the powers of a person, say the spiritual powers as sight. The physical eye of a person can see nothing. Physical ear can hear nothing without the nefesh in it. But there's the same nefesh in the eye as in the ear. That gives the eye the sight and gives the ear the power of hearing. There's one nefesh with different parts to it. These different parts to the nefesh, in order to really analyze the nefesh well, Rambam says there are five different parts, or better said, five different functions of the nefesh in a person. And to discuss each one of these functions, we'll understand well the makeup, complete makeup of a person himself. The five Hebrew terms, we'll state the five terms, then we'll take them each one separately. First one is called Hazon. Hazon means the provider. The second is Hamargish, the feeling, the power of feeling. Third is Hamadame, the power of imagination. The fourth is Hamisoide, the power of arousing. The fifth is hasichli, the mentality. Hazon, the power that provides, the neshama provides for the body. What does it provide for the body? It provides life itself. Life in the sense that the body, the person, now the person with this nefesh, can grow, can develop physically. How is that done? It gives the person the different powers, physical powers, that are necessary for development. For example, the working of the digestive tract, a very complex tract, where a person imbibes food, he takes food into the body, and then the entire digestive tract begins to work on it in different forms, different functions, different operations, where the food is distributed to the different parts of the body. Some of it is turned into the bloodstream, some goes up to the mind, food to the mind. Then, of course, there is the waste matter, which in turn is eliminated. Well, the body has the powers to perform all these functions with food. What gives the body the powers? That part of the soul, the nefesh, which is called the zon. This too, it gives the body the power to rejuvenate itself. For example, the body goes to sleep. Body that is completely exhausted, has no more energy. In sleep, there is a renewal of energy. This is feeding the body, not food, but feeding the body new life, new energy, new development. So through this power of the zon, a person can develop, can grow,
can also reproduce. The same one body can bring forth more of itself. Again, this is the Zun, the part of the Nefesh, which injects into the body this power of reproduction. But not only that, more so, it reproduces exactly the same as itself. It's called the Meilid Kedema. It gives birth to the same form as itself. A person will never give birth to a different form, to an animal, to a bird, a different living thing. A person will reproduce its own form exactly through the power of the Nefesh, which gives the body the ability to reproduce exactly a person as itself. Of course, there are no two people who are alike. Never have there been two alike, never will there be. But still, they are all, in a sense, the same humans. This is all included in the one function of Zon. Zon, to provide all these living powers and necessities of life and development. Second power or function of the Nefesh is the Margish, feeling, which means simply what is known as the five senses. How does the person see? How is it that his eye can photograph something which is at a distance or close by, could detect, make out differences between things that are before him? This is the power of sight, one of the abilities given to the body by the Nefesh. That part of the Nefesh called the Margish, the senses. Second is the power of hearing, to detect the difference between words or sounds or music or any type of sound. The third is Tom, taste. By taste, a person can develop a taste for something or reject something which he doesn't like. The fourth is Reach, the power of smell, the sense of smell. And the fifth is Mishush, the sense of touch. A person can touch and understand, even with his eyes closed, with his ears blocked, with the other four senses closed, by touching something, he can move his fingers over the item and tell what it is. There's a sense given to him of understanding where he can tell, by touch alone, what the item is, whether it's soft, whether it's round, shape, and so on. These are the five senses, all fall into the category of Margish, the second function of the Nefesh. Third function of the Nefesh, Medame, is the power of imagination. This could be used for a good purpose. A person can figure out something with his five senses. He could see and hear at the same time. His mind, his imagination, puts together, combines these two things, or three. He could judge, he can evaluate by using these senses, with his mind, conjure up a vision of something which he doesn't see by using his judgment, his imagination. Or he could divide, separate things that have to be separated. He sees something, he understands through his imagination what this item is composed of, different ingredients. All this falls under the category of imagination. Of course, too, the majority of cases, the imagination is synonymous with falsehood, lies. When a person uses imagination, it generally is for something that is false or non-existent, or the impossible. A person imagines himself as an unusual hero, or as a Superman, or as a genius that's far above his own intellect. A person imagines something which is a fantasy, something which is not natural. And this is something where the senses cannot conceive. And I'm going to give three examples where the senses cannot see or discover these three items. They must go under the category of imagination. One, a person who is so tall that his head reaches the heavens and his feet stand on earth. This is the impossible. You'll never see that. But your mind's imagination can conceive of something like that. You can imagine that which is impossible. Well, the second case, an animal with 1,000 eyes. 1,000 eyes in any animal, you can have an insect with 1,000 feet or 100 feet. You got to find an animal with 1,000 eyes. There are certain types of biological species, insect life, microscopic type of life, which do have unusual forms. But this example that Amram gives is one that is non-existent. None has 1,000 eyes. Of course, there could be a very deep message involved in these items. You won't analyze them because you won't go into this as you would into a Zohar Kodesh. There may be a deeper message involved, maybe. The Gemara says that the Malach HaMavis is Kulei Einayim, all eyes. It could be a Musa message here, but we'll leave that to the Bali Musa. Third item that Amma mentions as imagination of the impossible is something which does not exist, he says, a ship, which generally travels in water, a ship flying through the air, which would be classified as an airship. In the days of the Rambam, this did not exist. There was no airship. A metal boat or a metal ship, a large vessel that could fly through the air, it's heavier than air, and fly through the air. This is the impossible. It takes a person's mind to conjure such a vision, to imagine something which is impossible. Abinazal once said, in his time, it was just as strange an item, just as impossible as in the days of the Rambam. Yet Abinazal said that he foretold there will come a time there will be large airships flying through the air. So it's strange. Again, there must be a hidden reason why that Amram used something. He picked on an item which he said is absolutely impossible, and yet we see it did materialize. This could represent something else, but this all falls under the category, the third function of the nefesh, which is the imagination. And of course, Abinazal says, as we say here, the majority of imagination is false. Benazel says that the real name of the Satan, the Yetzirah nowadays, is the Koyach HaMedame, the power of imagination. As a person can delude himself into thinking falsely through having his imagination mislead him. A person can daydream and think he's accomplishing when actually he's doing nothing. Accomplishing nothing at all. Or even a person can, through his imagination, begin to have hidhudim roim, chas v'shalom, bad thoughts. And so the imagination is the key that the satan has to penetrating into the heart through the mind of a person, this koyach hamedame, that can lead a person into the worst type of sin, chas v'shalom. It's this function that is the most dangerous of all. The other two functions, the me'ida, one that arouses a person, there are a number of items that are involved in arousing a person to different types of action. The sichli, the mentality of a person governed by the nefesh, this requires further elaboration. We'll have this in the next shiur. We'll continue the Shemana Prokim, Mitz Hashem. We should be zecher to develop our koyach hanefesh, b'kedusha, the sacredness of the nefesh, with emuna only. And with this emuna and the Torah, Kedusha, and the Tzadik, Yemen, Zeh, and the Tzadik, 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 and the Tzadik